These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by The Teaching Company. These lectures are titled The Discovery of Ancient Civilizations, Part 2. Lecture 13, A Revolution in Archaeology.
Now we come to the second part of this course on the discovery of the ancient civilizations. We've come to a watershed. By the time Heinrich Schliemann dug into Hiselik, as we already described, a revolution in archaeological research was beginning. Part two of this course begins with the persistent theme that follows us right through to the end, which is the increasing impact of science on the discovery of the ancient civilizations. In this lecture, we describe the beginnings of a new era in archaeology, when science replaced adventure and the search for the spectacular gradually gave way to a concern with small objects and increasingly some degree of conservation, of saving the past. We describe how the revolution began in German hands, with Carl Lepsius's expedition to the Nile in 1846-49. Then we survey the remarkable career of archaeologist and part-time diplomat Auguste Mariette, a Frenchman, who almost single-handedly set up Egypt's National Museum and began the effort to save ancient Egypt for posterity. And then finally, we assess the significance of Austrian and German excavations on the island of Samothrace in the Aegean and at Olympia on the Greek mainland, which used new digging methods and were as much concerned with recording and conservation as they were with discovery. And we also consider the impact of these excavations on the wider scenario of the discovery of the ancient civilizations. By the time Schliemann electrified the world with his discoveries at Troy and Mycenae, there were the beginnings of a reaction against the rough and ready excavation methods of the pioneers, against the wholesale looting and destruction of ancient civilizations. This reaction came from many sources. It came from scholars. It came from local governments, because for the first time, you see the very, very first stirrings of nationalism in Greece, in Egypt, and elsewhere. And it came also from tourists. And as we will see, the tourist played an important part in the changing tide of public attitude towards ancient civilizations. German scholars, who were rigorous in their classical training, were in the forefront of what became a revolution in archaeological methods. Here again, as was the case in Egypt with Napoleon, and again with the French in Mesopotamia with Paul-Émile Botha, it was a government that really changed things. King Wilhelm IV of Prussia, who had an interest both in archaeology and in the prestige of his state, the prestige which would accrue to his government and his kingdom as a result of being a generous sponsor of archaeological inquiry, sponsored a three-year expedition to Egypt under the leadership of one of the great Egyptologists of the 19th century, Carl Lepsius. Lepsius was born in 1810. By 1842, when he led this expedition to Greece, he was a highly respected scholar and a member of the Prussian establishment. He was sent there for 3 years. The objective was to record as much as possible, not just to collect, although collecting was a primary purpose of the expedition, but the collecting was to be done under scientific conditions. In a way, this expedition was a logical follow-up to the modest, poorly funded work of the Egyptologist John Gardner Wilkinson, whom we described as one of the instruments of the very early development of Egyptology. was also a follow-up to some degree of Champollion's triumphant expedition of 1828-9 when he read inscriptions by moonlight. But that one did not achieve very much compared with Wilkinson's work, which of course resulted in his masterpiece, The Manners and Customs of the Ancient Egyptian. Lepsius and his colleagues, and it was a team of people, driven by a strong nationalistic impact. There was a wonderful picture of Lepsius and his colleagues celebrating the King of Prussia's birthday atop one of the pyramids, waving flags and everything. They were very enthusiastic, and yet very sober. They returned from Germany to Germany with more than 15,000 artifacts and plaster casts, as well as a mass of carefully recorded information, inscriptions, and so on. Not that they didn't commit excesses. For example, they dynamited a column from the tomb of Seti I, which was painted and given to Prussia's monarch as a gift from the Egyptian pastor. But, and this is the big difference, and here clearly the King of Prussia was looking over his shoulder at Napoleon's example, Lepsius and his colleagues recorded their finds in a magnificent 12-volume work, Denkmale aus Ägypten und Ethiopien, which is a book on the antiquities of Egypt. It was published in 1849 to 1859, over a 10-year period, and a 5-volume text appeared much later, from 1897 to 1913. Unlike the Description de l'Egypte, which revealed ancient Egyptian civilization to an astounded world, the Denkmale was much more of an archive, of a basic repository of data. And this repository is still of fundamental importance to Egyptologists to this day. It established a precedent of systematic recording, of much more careful science, where knowledge was as important as specimens. No one should underestimate the importance of the Lepsius expedition and its royal patronage. Lepsius himself was an extremely distinguished Egyptologist whose career spent in all sorts of other things like diplomacy, but the example he set was to bear fruit in Greece in the 1870s and to have a profound effect on scholarly opinion about the importance of conserving ancient Egypt. A year after the Lepsius expedition departed, a young Frenchman named Auguste Mariette arrived in Egypt. His mission, to collect manuscripts for the Louvre Museum in Paris. Mariette started off his career as a teacher, but he became interested in Egyptology through a relative's collection, a relative who had accompanied Champollion to Egypt. He rapidly, like so many people do, became obsessed with the ancient Egyptians. He moved to Paris, gave up being a teacher, and eventually got a job as an assistant keeper in charge of manuscripts at the Louvre, at best a humble position. In 1850, he was sent to Egypt, the first time he'd been out of Europe, to collect manuscripts from Coptic monasteries. At the time, there was somewhat of a scramble to collect these because it had been discovered that many monasteries had priceless collections of early Christian manuscripts. Mariette arrived to find that the monks were bitterly opposed to collectors, as the British had been somewhat unscrupulous in the years before. A lesser man would have returned to Paris and admitted his failure. But Mariette was interested in archaeology, and he decided to dig instead. He went to Memphis, the ancient capital of the Egyptian kings. He went to Memphis to find graves. And he remembered that Memphis in the late period of Egyptian history had been an important center of the Apis bull cult, a cult of sacred bulls of certain colors who were worshipped like a god and then buried. He started excavating at a place called the Serapeum, where it was said these Apis bulls were interred. He was rewarded with a spectacular discovery of an undisturbed bull burial in the midst of the havoc of looting which had decimated the Serapeum. Normally he would have been in big trouble with the Louvre, but the French were really pleased with his discovery, and he was promoted and continued to work in Egypt. But another thing happened to Mariette as he dug in the Serapeum. He became increasingly horrified by the destruction of Egypt's past by collectors and dealers and looters on every side. There had been an effort by the Egyptians themselves in 1835 to start an ancient Egyptian museum or national museum in Cairo, but it failed. Egyptians as a whole were not interested in Egypt, and in fact it was not until 1868 that the first account of ancient Egypt written by an Egyptian was to appear. But in 1857, and French influence in Egypt was considerable, very largely because of the building of the Suez Canal, Mariette was appointed the Director of Ancient Monuments for Egypt. His responsibility, to form a new museum of antiquities in Cairo. As a building, he was given a leaky outhouse in an old palace. Lesser people would have given up at once. But Mariette declared war on the dealers and looters by the simple expedient of doing what they did. He excavated literally dozens of sites at breakneck speed, one step ahead of them. How could he do this? He had the privilege of raising corvée, forced labor from villagers who were forced by the government to work for him digging sites. So he used this privilege to expand excavation in the name of government massively. The destruction he wrought was extraordinary. But in the long term, he was successful. His methods were really rough. They were hasty. But he prevented many fine treasures from leaving Egypt. He also was not above resorting to violence. When he heard that the jewelry of a famous New Kingdom queen named Ahotep, who died in about 1570 BC, had been found near Luxor and was being smuggled downstream in a boat, he gave chase and literally took control of the treasure with his fists flying. Mariette was a part-time diplomat as well as an archaeologist. He was responsible, almost single-handedly, for building on the impetus given by Lepsius and starting a new era in Egyptology, which, despite its rough methods, tended to stress science over treasure hunting. So you're talking about a new era. But probably Mariette's greatest triumph came with the opening of the Suez Canal. Just before it, there was a huge Paris exposition. World fairs were very fashionable in the 19th century. They were a form of public entertainment. And there was a magnificent Egyptian exhibit at this World's Fair, at which Egyptian antiquities, including the treasure or the jewelry of Queen Ahotep, were displayed and admired widely. And the Empress Eugenie of France, and France was a major investor, the major investor in the Suez Canal, graciously indicated that she would be pleased to receive this jewelry as a gift. Now, the Pasha of Egypt was heavily in debt. He couldn't afford to offend the French government. But it was a great moment for archaeology when he said, "Madam, I do not have the power to give this to you. There was one in Cairo who I must consult." And thank goodness for archaeology, Auguste Mariette said no. The treasure returns to Egypt. Eugenie was upset, but the Suez Canal was built. And in one of the delicious ironies of history, Auguste Mariette was deputed to take the emperor and empress on a tour of the monuments of the Nile. One senses he probably enjoyed it. He was a man of remarkable talents. He was responsible for the libretto for Aida, Verdi's opera performed in the new Cairo Opera House. He was involved in various behind-the-scenes diplomatic activities, but his greatest achievement was the founding of the Cairo Museum at Boulak. Eventually a building was built. He also encouraged the training of Egyptologists, but not, interestingly, of Egyptian Egyptologists, Egyptian-born Egyptologists. Others encouraged this. He did not. He felt it was a European matter. Eventually, he died in Egypt. A widower, he died of diabetes, and an era passed. But with the passing of this era, the sea change had begun. The Lepsius expedition had set much higher standards of archaeological reportage and scientific investigation. Mariette had vigorously opposed the export of many antiquities, although there were huge holes in his arguments, huge holes in his methods. Much was destroyed and removed. At least he began to sway Egyptian and public opinion against the destruction of the past. But the person who looked best out of this was the Kaiser of Prussia. And the Lepsius expedition, with its lavish volumes, reflected well on Prussian patronage of science. Now, the Germans and the Austrians had long been active in classical archaeology. Rigorous training in literature, philology, and so on. And now they began to extend this rigor to another part of their work, classical archaeology. Classical archaeology to this day is much concerned with art and architecture. It isn't so much concerned, as prehistoric archaeologists are, with the minutiae of settlements and towns and villages and the lives of common folk, although this is changing. But this tradition dates back, architecture and art, particularly to the German researches of the 1870s. Now, the Germans were very, very smart. And they realized, which was a major breakthrough, that there were two interests in this research involved. The one was theirs, to collect fine antiquities, to acquire information. But increasingly the thinking was that the information was more prestigious than the objects. And secondly, it was clear that they must collaborate closely with local authorities who were concerned about the wholesale export of antiquities, which were part of a natural national patrimony, which was increasingly valued, especially in Greece, which had its independence from Turkey and valued it very highly. Then there was another factor coming into play, just beginning because of steamships and so on. This was an increasing tourist traffic, a traffic that in Egypt increased tenfold with the digging of the Suez Canal. With this huge traffic, which went by steamship to Suez and then through the Red Sea to India, to and fro from the English colonies, British colonies in India, you got people stopping to go to the pyramids. You got winter visitors coming out to spend the winter away from the damp English cold. And Egypt became a fashionable place. So did Greece. So there were beginnings of a tourist trade. And it was beginning to be realized that museums and monuments had economic value as attractions. This, of course, did not reach its full potential until the 20th century, but clearly it was beginning here. And the Germans played to this. For example, in 1873 and 1875, an Austrian archaeologist, Alexander Kohns, was dispatched to the island of Samothrace with the authority of the Emperor of Austria, who was anxious to emulate the Prussians. A warship was anchored offshore and served his every need as he excavated the famous sanctuary of the Kabiri there. He took with him an architect and a draftsman. And the excavations were published in full, complete with finely executed plans and photographs, the first ever to appear in an excavation report. Now, these weren't popular works. Neither Lepsius's great monographs or the Samothrace reports, they were nothing like Layard's Nineveh and its remains, or John Lloyd Stephen's Incidents of Travel. With these publications, the study of ancient civilizations had advanced to a new and more specialized plane. A plane which in many ways made these civilizations less accessible to a general audience, but made them very, very detailed in their focus, and from this came knowledge which did percolate out. We were getting to a level where people were really beginning to think about early civilizations, not just found them and say, gee, this is wonderful. The Germans followed the Austrians. In 1870, a branch of the German Archaeological Institute was opened in Athens. Under the sponsorship of this institute, which was a research organization, another archaeologist, Ernst Curtius, a highly respected classical scholar, and architect Friedrich Alder, turned their attention to Olympia in the Peloponnese, the site of the fabled Olympic Games. If you go to Olympia today, you can see the results of their excavation. A whole ruin field of fragments, a collapsed temple, the amphitheater where the games were performed, the passageway through which the athletes emerged. They worked there from 1875 to 1880. In a new departure, which rippled through the world of archaeology, the German government renounced all claims to the finds and received only duplicates. Not only that, they built a museum at Olympia and carefully recorded every building, every find, and the museum stands there to this day. And they published their results. Finally, the world had realized that excavation wasn't just digging. It was recording and recording data that was being destroyed as you dug. That any record you made was a record for posterity, for permanence, for future generations of scholars, for humanity. And that a big dig should combine conservation with recording and publication. They set a magnificent example, an ideal. And of course, you can only do that if you have enormous government budgets behind you. But they made the point. There was still a great deal of illicit looting going on. The British Museum in particular was very aggressive through its keepers in acquiring papyri, clay tablets from Mesopotamia, and any finds they could get. But there were the beginnings of a conscience. And this conscience came from another unexpected direction as well. In 1877, an English novelist, Amelia Edwards, published an account of a leisurely journey up the Nile, called 1,000 Miles Up the Nile. In it, she said how absolutely horrified she was by the destruction around her. Inadvertently, she was ushered into a forger's workshop where scarabs were aged by feeding them through the digestive tracts of turkeys. This lady was a popular novice. She wrote mushy romantic novels. But she devoted the rest of her life to fighting for the conservation of ancient Egypt, for the conservation of a civilization that was fundamental to our understanding of humanity. And her impact was enormous, because she reached out to the public. What was happening was that a new era in archaeology was beginning, one that saw the first appearance of professional archaeologists in the field. Today, if you encounter a professional archaeologist, that person, if they have a PhD, has probably gone through between 4 and 7 years of detailed specialized training. There was no such thing back in the late 19th century. You acquired archaeological experience by apprenticing yourself to someone like Ernst Curtius, or later Leonard Woolley, and you learnt the hard way. You went and dug, then you went out on your own. But at least from these people, you acquired a sense of ethic, a sense of the desirability of publication, a sense that scholarship was more important than treasure hunting. I said much earlier in this course that the ancestry of archaeology is one which is deeply embedded in treasure hunting. This was the point where the treasure hunting began to recede into the background and indeed go underground, because for the first time, the search for the ancient civilizations was in the hands of a small coterie of full-time scholars. Their results were still rough by today's standards. They would dig in a month more than would take 5 years for an archaeologist to dig today, probably longer. They used picks and shovels rather than camel hair brushes. They had no technology. Their recording was rudimentary at best, and at times a disgrace. But at least they established the traditions of a serious long-term field research which continued into the 21st century. It was sponsorship by governments and museums and wealthy philanthropists and the first academically trained researchers who were in large part responsible for a new consciousness of the finite nature of the record of early civilizations. Archaeology began to come of age, and one of the reasons it became of age was because of better excavation, not only in the Mediterranean, but also in England. There, a retired general, who by an extraordinary concatenation of circumstances inherited enormous quantities of land and huge fortune, sat down to excavate sites which hitherto had just been shoveled. His name was General Lane Fox Pitt-Rivers. He was a martinet, and his hobby was the evolution of firearms. But in the 1880s, he excavated a series of earthworks and burial mounds and forts on his lands in southern England, developing methods where he would dig a site completely, but record the position of every artifact, every bone fragment, try and reconstruct the layers of the mound so he could see how it was built and reconstruct, and then publish everything. His walls were straight. His workmen would stand at attention in the picture, giving the scale. He distinguished the minutest layers. And in this, he founded a tradition of meticulous recording, which, if anything, was more precise, although it was on a smaller scale, than that of the Germans. His work was ignored by his contemporaries, who were casual in the extreme, because the point that Pitt-Rivers made by his example is that excavation is a very responsible thing and has to be done very carefully. And it was not until the 1920s that his methods began to spread widely in Britain, Europe, and then to the Near East. But, as we will see in the next lecture, archaeology changed rapidly in the hands of a new breed of archaeologists, one of whom, Egyptologist Flinders Petrie, another Englishman, insisted on the importance of the small object. And with the small object, the modern history of civilization discovery begins.